From the campus of Yale University, this is Business Talk with Jim Campbell, nationally syndicated across the country on the Biz Talk Radio Network and coming to you from our flagship stations, Yale Radio WYBC and 1490 AM WGCH Greenwich. All talk and all business, 60 minutes of radio with leading figures from the world of business along with the business of politics and sports. He was a role model, a moral crusader, a beloved entertainer, leading dual lives. The downfall of America's dad, after brazenly drugging and raping more than 60 women, took 13 years, three trials, two juries, courageous women, inside the story of bringing Bill Cosby to justice. Nicole Wisenseed Egan has been the lead investigative journalist reporting on the Cosby case since 2005, first for the Philadelphia Daily News and then as a senior writer for People magazine, oftentimes the only journalist staying with the case throughout. And her new book is just out, is Chasing Cosby, The Downfall of America's Dad. Thanks, Nikki, for doing this.
Thanks for having me on.
And thanks for staying with this story, by the way. You were kind of alone. And by the way, the two of us share, we both worked on the Madoff thing a little bit. I got a book coming, but you did some Madoff stories for People, right?
Yeah, yes, I did. And I got some exclusive interviews with Andrew Madoff after he sadly got sick. And got to know his fiancée, Catherine, pretty well. So, yeah, I did a lot of that coverage. That was not an easy story to cover. So
no, and interestingly,
I can't imagine how hard the book is to write.
Yeah, and interestingly, of course, Madoff had a purely good reputation until this happened, too, as Cosby had a great reputation. Let me start off with, did you think justice would ever be done? Did you get cynical about the whole thing?
Oh, absolutely. When I saw in 2005 how the DA didn't even want to investigate this, I seemed to be giving preferential treatment to Cosby very early on. It seemed likely that nothing was ever going to come of this. And then when he decided to not file charges after less, than a month of investigating, it seemed like that was it. You know, she filed her civil suit against him that, went on its way and got resolved in a year and a half later, and they settled, and that was it. So I really thought that was the end of that case.
The media's, has kind of got ADD. They didn't stay with this, obviously, during this gap. Did it become an obsession with you, or that your paper, had the courage and wanted to keep with it in Philadelphia?
No, I wouldn't say it was an obsession. I mean, in fact, the rest of the media in 2005 just wouldn't touch the story. They were controlled by Cosby, either through his threats of suing them or, promises of future favors, and they just, backed off the story very quickly. And I kept getting more information and more women were coming forward, so I just kept reporting it. It was just a good story, and I believed the women, and I believed, there was something to these allegations. There were 13 other women accusing him in 2005, 13 women who didn't know each other, who had very similar stories to tell and had told other people along the way. How could they all be making something like this up, and why would they? I mean, it kind of gets to me when people say, oh, they want attention, they want to be on TV. Who wants to be famous for being raped?
And for going after a guy with Cosby's image.
It is the scariest thing in the world to go after a powerful man like him, especially one with a, as even Hanwell Burroughs later said, a public Teflon image. He was, one of the most powerful men in the country, in Hollywood, and just, whose public image was unassailable.
Unassailable. Were you or the Philly Daily News or People threatened by his lawyers?
We were at the Philadelphia Daily News, yes, and I was personally. I mean, Marty Singer was calling me pretty regularly, trying to get me to back off stories or threatening to sue, and he had sent letters to my newspaper, and I believe, I can't confirm this because People was very secretive about everything during my time there, but I think he was also doing the same thing to People.
Let me ask you this, because we're going to go into detail later on, obviously, but I think it's an important thing that you address, is that there's a lot of criticism of women when they don't come forward right away. And this woman who we'll talk about, Andrea Constand, waited a year, apparently had 53 conversations with Cosby after this attack. Explain why this is not an abnormal thing.
Well, first of all, she worked for Temple University. Bill Cosby was on the board of trustees at Temple University. He was very close friends with her boss, Dawn Staley, who was the women's basketball coach. Andrea was the director of operations. Those 53 phone calls were work-related, and they were her returning calls he made to him. It was about Temple business. She was not in a position where she could not return the phone calls of a member of the board of trustees, a person who was very close friends with her own boss. So that has been, you know, twisted and made right. into something it was not. Delayed reporting is the norm in sexual assault cases. It is not a lot of women wait. It is the most underreported violent crime there is.
Yes.
And, you know, a lot of women wait. And, you know, 85% of sexual assaults, the women know their person who raped them. Like, only 15% are actually strangers. So there's a lot of factors here that play into why a person, you know, would wait and be scared to go to police. She was also drugged, so yeah. she had shaky memory of what had happened. And it was just a very, just a disconnect for her. This is a man who had mentored her for 15 months. He was a grandfather figure to her. He was 10 years older than her own father. And she just couldn't fathom what had happened, that he, you know, that someone like him, this public icon, would do something as awful as drugging and sexually assaulting her. So it took her a really long time to come to terms with that. And what finally made her go to police was she was having nightmares over that year. And in these nightmares, she was waking up screaming. And in these nightmares, she was seeing other women being sexually assaulted because she hadn't come forward and told police what had happened.
Wow.
So that's what finally prompted her to do it. She was terrified this was going to happen to someone else.
Do you think that if Cosby's defense had been this, that it was a sickness, it might have been a different outcome for him? Or it's just the guy was so arrogant he was going to deny this to all to his death?
I don't know that that matters in the sentencing part of this. If he had pled guilty and tried to negotiate some kind of plea where yeah. he would, you know, go to therapy and stuff, but he won't. He wouldn't even meet with the sex offender assessment psychologist. He absolutely refused.
Yeah.
And he did not cooperate with probation when they were doing their pre-sentence investigation. So, I mean, as far as answering a lot of questions, the only psychologist he cooperated with was one he hired, and he wouldn't answer any questions about the sexual assault.
Do you know, I watched the Michael Jackson documentary that was out recently, and I was struck how this grooming process and how similar it was, how he would ingratiate himself with the parents of these folks, even after he'd had sexually assaulted them, and very similar to what Michael Jackson did.
Yes, I mean, it was a very, when you see it laid out, as I do in the book, I think you can pretty clearly see the pattern. He would go to their agents and ask to mentor them, and then he would speak to their parents first and gain their trust, and then he would speak to the women, and he would create this trusting situation. He would say, I want to mentor you. I want to help you. He would shower them with attention and advice. And then when he got them in an environment that he controlled, he would drug and sexually assault them. And then he would toss them aside.
Now, when Andrea's mother confronts him on the phone and tapes the call, he seems to acknowledge, right, that I'm a monster, and seems to show that he understands he's doing something wrong. Not totally
denied.
Yes,
he does. He tells her, I'm a sick man,
yes.
you know, and he apologized. But in the same, you know, conversation, he also tells her, Mom, she had an orgasm.
Yeah.
Who says that to a mother about her daughter when the mother is saying, you drugged and sexually assaulted my daughter, but Mom, she had an orgasm. It's just so grotesque.
It's grotesque, and she's unconscious, and she was also gay, right?
Yes.
So in the sense that, you know, she would not naturally have, you know, it wouldn't be at her fault, in other words. Let me ask you if we can put this in the context. Some of this went back as far as the 70s. And I know in that era...
The first earliest known one is 1964.
64, okay. Roman Polanski, Hollywood drugs all the time, drugging younger women. Does he get any I don't want to say, space let off, but that there was a culture of some of this behavior?
This is totally different than, you know, giving people drugs and recreational using drugs. And, you know, it's the 60s, it's the 70s, it's the crazy time. This is people taking two sips of a drink they thought was something else and then passing out and waking up 8 hours later knowing something, you know, they'd been raped. This is not recreational consensual drug use in most of these cases. And even in some, like, you just, I don't know, some of these cases, you just wonder what was in the drinks too. Some of them, there were a couple cases where he told the woman, you know, here's a Quaalude, and they took it. They were as Therese Sarignis, one of them said, he just knew she was a passive person, and that she is, and so she just did it. They didn't understand what it was going to do to them, that it took away their ability to consent to anything that was happening to them.
Now, I read in your book that Cosby's father was an alcoholic and not really a presence in his life, and he never touched drink or drugs himself, was kind of a control freak. His son was murdered. I mean, where does this come from? Do you have any, you know, putting this together? Is it just control, or?
I mean, it seems, you know, again, I don't want to be an armchair psychologist right. here. I'm not qualified. But, you know, there definitely seems to be a pattern of Cosby Lycan to be in control. And he said in the bio that he cooperated with Mark Whitaker, he said in there he'd only had 3 sips of a drink once when he was a teenager wow. and didn't like the loss of control, so he stopped. I mean, how much loss of control do you have with 3 sips? I mean, and if you look at this ultimately, it is the ultimate way to control someone is to drug them. They're helpless. They cannot fight. These women couldn't move. They were paralyzed. It took away their memory, most of the memory of what happened to them. It took away their ability to fight back. They were completely under his control, and he could do whatever he wanted to them, and there was nothing they could do about it.
You're listening to Fisner Talk with Jim Campbell. Next, Cosby on Trial. We're talking with investigative journalist Nikki Wisenzee-Egan. Her book is Chasing Cosby. For people that may not know, give a little bit on the backstory of Andrea, what happened, how she suffered, and why the prosecution did not decide to go forward with charges then.
You know, I can tell you what she said in her victim impact statement. I mean, this really, you know, had an impact on her. She lost her ability to trust. She was a pretty carefree, easygoing person. She, you know, played basketball her entire life. She was one of the top 5 high school basketball players in Canada. She was recruited by 50 to 60 of the top universities in the U.S. to play for them, and she chose the University of Arizona. She dreamed of playing for the WNBA one day, and she went to Italy to play for a while, and then when it became clear that she wasn't going to be able to play for the WNBA, she got recruited for this job at Temple by Dawn Staley, where she was director of operations for the women's basketball team. So it was a way to still be a part of the basketball world, but even if she wasn't playing. And that's how she met Cosby. And again, she didn't introduce herself to him. A donor introduced Cosby to her at a game, at a basketball game at the Leo Cora Center in Philly in November, I think, of 2002. And then he started calling her and with stuff about the team, like, oh, you know, do you guys need money for the locker room? Dawn isn't trying to pay for that out of her own money again, is she? And that's how it started. And he it's interesting because in his deposition that became public a decade later in her case, he says basically that he had his eye on her romantically from the minute he saw her. And it was just predator and prey thing going on where he just, you know, slowly tried to reel her in over the next 15 months. She was a broadcast journalist, a broadcast journalism major, and had thought about sports broadcasting. So he started introducing her to people he knew that could help her with that. He helped her get a headshot. You know, he bought her a hair dryer to straighten her hair. He loved to do that with women for some reason. A lot of the other women have said that. And so, you know, but he had his eye on her from the very get-go. He knew from the minute he saw her, he wanted to have a romantic relationship with her. Well, she was oblivious. I mean, she viewed him, he was older than her own father. She never looked at him as anything more than a grandfather figure.
And doesn't he, in his deposition stuff, he admits that he gives drugs to some, and that with Andrea, he basically admitted what he did and that it was somewhere between consent and non-consent, and I just kept going forward, things like that?
Yes, yeah. I mean, it is mind-boggling when you read that deposition. I mean, he said what he gave her was Benadryl, though. He still claims that's what it was, although he told her mother in the other phone call, he said it was a prescription, and he wanted to go up and read the prescription bottle, and then he came back down and said, I can't read it. I will write it down on a piece of paper and send you the name of the drug. Because, of course, the mother was worried. She's like, what did you give my daughter? Because Andrea, when she came home, was not herself. She was withdrawn. She was depressed. She was losing weight. And then when she found out what happened, she worried that whatever drug he had given her had done something to her. And she also worried, like, she's like, why didn't you call 911? You know, how did you know she was going to wake back up after you gave her that drug? And that's true with so many of these women. It is very dangerous to give people drugs without their knowledge or their consent.
And then let them drive.
You don't know if they're allergic to it. Yeah. You don't know if they're allergic to it. You don't know what else they have in their system. Right. And then if they drive, some of the women aren't really sure how they didn't get in a car accident afterward because they were so whacked out by whatever had been slipped into their drink. So it is a very dangerous thing to do.
Is his wife Camille is she an enabler, or is she just, they live separate lives and didn't really, you know, wasn't in on all this?
I don't know. I mean, I tend to think she's protecting their empire. You know, it's all about finances.
Okay.
It's cheaper to keep him. I mean, he's in jail. What's it costing her to stay with him? Why should she divorce him? She has controlled the money in their relationship since the early 70s, according to the one book.
Really?
What the one book said, because he nearly lost everything with one of his managers. So after that, she took over their finances. So she has not been to see him in prison. None of his kids have.
Really? So
she has no motive to divorce him. I mean, she has control of all the money anyway.
So she might be happier he's in prison.
Right. She could be. But no, but she keeps coming out defending him. So, you know, yeah. I think she's trying to protect the empire, too.
So they settle on a civil case for $3 million, and then there's a non-disclosure, right?
$3.38 million, yes.
That boggles.
And he also had her parents sign it, which was odd.
That boggles my mind, doesn't it? I mean, how much, and then how much innocence can you claim? And does she feel bad that
that's not nuisance money? That's not $100,000.
I know exactly.
Get out of here money, right?
Yeah, just saying. Okay, I just paid her to go away. And does Andrea, in retrospect, feel bad that she'd signed the non-disclosure?
No, I mean, you know, I think I don't know. I mean, she's not allowed to talk about it, so I don't
know. That's
a good point. But I mean, it's not. It's definitely the norm for that to happen. It's what I think. What's sad is that, you know, apparently this confidentiality agreement just applies to him, because he's out there doing interviews. His spokespeople are out there still disparaging her when none of that is supposed to be happening under their agreement. He's done many media interviews since. So
this morning,
yeah, I mean, but I think at that point, you know, there wasn't. But she just wanted it to go away. I mean, she had to sit there in the deposition. He was there, and it was awful. And apparently there were tears, and the way they treated her was awful in her own deposition. I think she just wanted to be done with it.
Bruce Castor was the prosecuting the U.S. attorney, or the whatever he was there. Was he intimidated by this? I mean, was there a reason why he didn't go forward with the evidence that existed?
No, I don't. I don't think he was at all intimidated. What I don't know is why he didn't want to go forward. Other than, I don't know if he had a prior relationship with the family. Like, I did discover that his father had been the attorney, had the power of attorney for the guy Cosby bought that house from, where Andrea said this happened, and Castor did not disclose that to the family. They run in these wealthy circles in that area, and so I don't know if there was a prior friendship or prior relationship there. Or, you know, he had just finished running for attorney general, and in Pennsylvania, there are no limits on individuals contributing to political campaigns. And he'd had a friend of his, Drew Lewis, who used to be the Secretary of Transportation under Reagan, gave him and his wife gave him $600,000 for his attorney general run right before the race, you know, right before the primary. So I don't know if he hoped for future, you know, donations and help for his future campaigns. All I know is he just did not want anything to do with this case from the very beginning. It was odd.
And
because I'd been covering him for years, and Bruce never saw a case he didn't want to get a headline about. I'm telling you, he would hold press conferences at the drop of a hat. This one, it was like radio silence for 4 days before he issued this one brief press release where he almost hinted that he was going to arrest Andrea. I mean, it's just the whole thing was just bizarre.
It's interesting to me, because I would have guessed that he was afraid to take on Cosby. You say
no.
No. That's interesting.
No, if anything, it more seemed like it was a friend or hoped to get future favors out of it. I don't know to this day what it was, but it was certainly never him being intimidated by him, unless he did want to alienate voters who might be Dr. Huxtable fans. But there was never any. Bruce isn't afraid of anything.
All right, we'll go back to Cosby on trial again in the next segment. Forensic Talk with Jim Campbell. All talk and all crime. The nation's biggest murderers were the go-to source for the Moxley murder and the Skakel appeals. Financial crimes on Wall Street. Inside the crimes of Russia's Putin and more. The facts, the forensics, the inside stories. From the host of Business Talk with Jim Campbell, it's Forensic Talk with Jim Campbell. All talk and all crime.
Learn more about Forensic Talk with Jim Campbell by visiting Park City Productions 06604's Facebook page. That's Park City Productions, 06604.
And we're talking with investigative journalist Nikki Wisenc Egan. Her book is Chasing Cosby. And one of the things I also learned in this is how underreported rape and sexual assault is, as well as the victim being on trial a lot. A lot of people believe that women lie about rape and assault, and the actual numbers are like under 10%, right, that are lies. Yeah. There's this shame, there's this guilt, you know, all this kind of stuff that the defense can then play with to say, you know, that she's, you know, shaking us down and she didn't come forward. How did the prosecution deal with all that? This putting this woman on first, or this sexual assault
expert?
Yeah,
they put her on first to say, you know, basically to debunk rape myths and basically explain victim behavior.
Yes.
And, you know, that it's the norm not to report, that most sexual assault victims don't even go to police, that it's the most underreported violent crime, that most sexual assault victims don't fight back. That's if they know the guy, sometimes they will keep in touch after because they're trying to sort it out and trying to make sense of it. And just really laid a really good groundwork and for what the jury was about to hear. And then it was the five women, other women testified, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And then
which was not allowed in the first trial, right?
Right. There was only one other victim that testified in the first trial. And there was a sexual assault expert allowed to testify, but she came much later in the trial. This time they put her on first, and it was brilliant. I mean, they had learned from their mistakes from the first
yes.
trial. They had spoken to the jurors, kind of got a sense of, like, what they did wrong, what they could do better, and they didn't want to use the same woman from the first trial because they are, you know, that would have given the new defense team a roadmap on how to cross-examine her. So that's why they asked for different women to testify at this trial.
Are you there every day? Were you there every day?
Yes, there every day.
Did it,
I was there for jury selection too.
Did it look to you like the jury was buying the argument? Could you tell that by looking up, or they're not? You can't tell.
Yeah, they were really paying close attention. They were taking a lot of notes. They just were a very serious jury that was very carefully paying attention to what was going on. And they were also a local jury. Now the first jurors were from Allegheny County, all the way across the state, which includes Pittsburgh. This because Cosby had wanted an out-of-town jury. This time, he agreed to not get an out-of-town jury, and that may have been a very big mistake.
Why?
Because Montgomery County jurors are Montgomery County is the wealthiest. Higher. They're well-educated.
Yeah.
They're more. You know, not. I'm not slamming Allegheny County. I have family from there, but I'm just saying. The juror foreperson is vice president of cybersecurity for an international emergency management firm.
Wow.
There was a bank president. There were just a lot of very, people who were really, another guy was an OSHA investigator, or it worked for OSHA.
Wow.
So there were just people with a lot of profession. They were very, very smart people.
Did the defense brutalize Andrea again, or?
Yes. I mean, in opening arguments, they called her a con artist. The cross-examination of the women was awful. In fact, Janice Baker Kinney said to Mesereau at one point, said, "Are you rolling your eyes at me?" And he said, "Yes." And then when Shalon Lasha was up there at the end, she was crying, God bless her, throughout her entire testimony. And at the end, she turned to Cosby and screamed, "You remember, don't you, Mr. Cosby?" And that's what also kills me with some of this. It's like they called him Mr. Cosby. That's what Andrea called him.
Yeah, that is weird. Yeah.
I mean, that was their relationship. He was Mr. Cosby. You know, he wasn't Bill, my boyfriend. He was Mr. Cosby. They had a professional/personal mentoring relationship. And that's the same thing he did with these other ones. That's what they called him.
Now, we watched those of us that would see parts of it on TV just going in and out of the courtroom. Was that blind stuff real? The way he was walking in, looking like he couldn't, that he was literally had to be held and everything. And
all I can tell you is that I at the first trial, he was sitting next to his attorney, but Brian McMonagle. Brian, I saw write something on a legal pad one time.
Mm-hmm.
Cosby looked down on it, appeared to read it, nodded, and then wrote something in return. And I can tell you in the bio with Whitaker, it says he had a certain kind of eye disease in one eye that was treated, and he got most of the sight back. So it was only in one eye. He definitely has something up with one of his eyes. But he never wore the black glasses in public before. He never used a cane before. All of those appeared on the day he turned himself in when he was arrested. Yeah. The cane rarely touches the ground if you watch.
Is that right?
Where
you're sitting, I assume that his back is to you. Were you able to see his demeanor at all?
Yeah, I kept a close eye on it because when you're writing and covering the trial, I was covering the second trial for the Daily Beast. And I covered the first one for People when I worked for them. And, that's part of what I tried to keep an eye on because, to get that kind of color in my story. So I kept it very
close. So you can actually see him? You can see him from where you are?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Okay. I would assume you're behind him so you'd see his back. But
No, I was sitting over on the prosecution side, so I could get a clear view of him.
What was his?
I wanted to keep an eye on the jurors so I could get their reactions.
What was his demeanor?
I mean, it was like he laughed inappropriately. There were times when he was smiling when, you know, Andrea was talking about some of her testimony. It was, you know, he had some really, really inappropriate reactions. He was joking outside of the courtroom, and, you know, the first trial he did, hey, 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 Fat Albert, coming out one day. I mean, it was, you'd never know what he was on trial for.
Do you think he believed he'd go to jail?
No, I think that he had always gotten his way, and I think that he was very surprised by it. In fact, that's why I think he definitely was surprised by the verdict, because that's when he lost it in court, and he screamed at the prosecutor when the prosecutor was trying to get bail lifted and have him go into custody immediately, because he said Cosby had a plane, and Cosby used to, but he didn't have one anymore. And Cosby screams, he doesn't have an airplane, you asshole.
Yeah.
And then goes, I'm sick of that guy.
You know,
and it was like the mask slipped for the first time, and you could really see like the true Bill Cosby.
It's just so typical of arrogance. Here are these, he's been convicted of raping women, and he's concerned that people think he has a plane still.
Or just, you know, and I was just looking at him going, he finally found a prosecutor he couldn't buy.
Yeah.
You made him mad.
Has it ever come out? Was it the date rape drug? Was it Quaaludes? Was it Xanax? Was it different things? Where was he? What was it?
We don't know.
Nobody knows.
We don't know. I mean, he said in his deposition he had 7 different prescriptions for Quaaludes. I mean, there's, you know, any number of central nervous system depressants that would have the effects that these women describe.
Which means they probably shouldn't be mixed with alcohol, right?
Exactly. That's why I said it's so dangerous to do this to someone. Without their consent. I mean, I got bitten by a dog years ago and had surgery, and they gave me Demerol when I was coming out of surgery. I broke out in hives all over my body, and they had to give me an antidote or I would have suffocated. I would have died. I had no clue I was allergic to Demerol until they gave it to me.
Wow.
So how do you know that someone isn't allergic to it, or that it might mix badly with whatever is in their system? You know, or just like I said, or they're so incapacitated, they get in a wreck when they leave. It's the scariest crime out there. I mean, I always say it's premeditated rape, because you are doing this on purpose to incapacitate someone so you can have your way with them.
You only got a 10-year sentence?
3 to 10 years. That's the max they could give.
So he might
under the guidelines. I mean, this is a by the book judge. He rarely gets overturned on appeal. And every decision he made very carefully.
So does 3 to 10 years mean he'll get out in 3?
No, 3 years is his minimum, and at that point the victims have a say in whether he gets out as well. And given that he is not, you know, accepting responsibility and admitting guilt and expressing remorse, it seems pretty unlikely that he, and that the victims have a say, you know, that he would. I mean, I imagine if he did truly apologize and truly express remorse and truly, you know, mean it, that would have some sway with the victims, too. But I don't, you know, that would have to happen for him to get out in 3 years.
So is it likely we think he'll die in prison?
He could. I mean, he's appealing his conviction and his sentence, but that takes years. You know, those appeals take years. And like I said, this judge rarely gets overturned on appeal. So I don't know what kind of chance he has. He's, you know, he actually stands up getting either one, you know, say he gets a new trial. I just don't see it. I mean, this judge carefully measured every decision he made. And like I said, he rarely gets overturned on appeal.
All right, just a few seconds left here. Some of the victims I wanted to talk about, but Tamara Green, it was 30 years ago that she was raped, and she finds Cosby visiting her brother, who has cystic fibrosis, in the hospital, right?
Right.
That's pretty sick stuff.
Yeah, but that's what he would do to so many of them. You know, there would be a reason that they wouldn't be able to go and do anything about what they did to them. He's very clever.
I interviewed Jane Tarsus. Did you talk
to her? Oh, yeah. Yeah, I interviewed Joan, yes.
What do you think about her story? And she was assaulted twice, including, one, I guess, brought her own parents, or Cosby invited her parents to go to a concert with him.
Oh, no, it's the same thing. Like, it happened to these women. Like they said, you know, there was no name. This, you're talking about the late 60s, early 70s. You know, back then, there was no name for what had happened to them. Rape was a stranger dragging you into an alley with a knife and raping you. It wasn't someone like Bill Cosby drugging you and forcing you to do something. There was no name for what was done to them. And also, you know, Tamara had this great line when people were saying that to her in 2005. Well, why didn't you go to police back then? She goes, well, you know, someone came to police in 2005 about it. How's that working out for her? And you could say the same thing today. I mean, I just saw a story in the New York Times today about sexual assault victims suing to get their rapists arrested because the police departments aren't doing it.
Wow. All right, our final segment.
These are stranger rapes again, too. I mean, these are not even acquaintance situations, which can be trickier.
Our final segment coming right up. Hey, she's a former People magazine senior writer and investigative reporter, Nikki Wisenc-Egan. The jury foreperson you got to interview, right? She was breaking her silence. What did you get out of her?
Cheryl Carmel, yes, and I interviewed another juror as well. I mean, she really took me through the whole process, the whole deliberations process. It was very interesting because something I had never thought about before is that nobody tells a jury how to deliberate. You know, they are given these guidelines. They are given, this is the law. You apply it here, you apply it there. But no one tells them once they get in the room what to do. You know, like, you vote immediately, you do this, you do that. So they really have to figure it out for themselves. And this jury showed it was quickly able to. They made Cheryl the jury foreperson, and they just started going through each witness and marking down whether they found them credible or not credible. And when they hit, and if they all agreed, they'd check, okay, credible, not credible. But when they got to two, they were two things they were not in agreement about or were unsure about. That was the testimony they wanted to rehear, one of which was Margot Jackson, the woman at Temple University who was a defense witness who claimed she shared a room with Andrea on a women's basketball trip the year before this happened, and that Andrea said she was going to set up a person to get money from them. But they wanted to hear that again, and then they wanted to hear part of Cosby's deposition testimony again.
Was that credible at all? That comment that she was going to set him up?
They did not find her credible. I kept waiting for the smoking gun. I thought, okay, this is this big witness. You know, they were mad. The defense team was mad. They couldn't have her testify in the first trial. Surely they must have some records to show that she went on this trip. There must be some proof somewhere. None they could find. They presented no proof other than, and she came forward 11 years later, which apparently is okay if you're a defense witness. But
yeah, exactly.
Victim.
Did this woman have
a production company, by the way, after the first trial too?
Did this woman have any incentive to lie, though? I mean, was she?
She started a production company after the first trial.
Oh,
I don't know.
Okay,
yes.
Okay, I get it.
Yeah, so that was, the only evidence that was presented was by the prosecution, and they found travel records for her for the February a year prior, but not for the February when she said this happened, when she shared a room with Andrea. And Andrea had testified that she never shared a room on these trips. And, you know, interestingly enough, the defense didn't call Dawn Staley, who was Cosby's friend, who would have been able to say for sure what the truth was, because she, of course, was the one who made these travel arrangements. And she was never called.
And
in the end, the jury, you know, in Pennsylvania, if you believe that, if you, finding a sexual assault victim credible is enough to convict. And in the end, that's what it was. The jury believed Andrea.
And it didn't sound like this jury had much doubt, right? I mean, initially or anything.
No.
It was pretty quick.
No, I mean, they had a couple of, whatever issues or concerns they had, they worked through very methodically. And when some people weren't remembering about Margot Jackson, the part about the expense reports and stuff, that's why they wanted to go back in and rehear the testimony so they could hear it for themselves, because they can't take anything back in the room with them. They're not allowed to, you know, get a police report to look at or to look at the testimony again. They have to go back into court and have it read back.
Really?
Yeah.
And they do that without anybody present there? Or?
No, the judge, they send a question out to the judge. The judge reads it. And to what they gathers us all back in the courtroom, and then they read it, and then and he answers it, and then, you know, he tells us what is going to do. And so that was what happened. And those were meanwhile, the first jury from the first case pretty much had almost the entire trial read back to them during their 52 hours of deliberations.
Do you, as you finish this up, do you say there's a, you know, one of the morals being out of this, that we shouldn't deify celebrities like this and icons, and where do you come down on that?
Definitely don't. Just don't confuse a celebrity with who they play on TV. I mean, we don't know who they really are. We have no clue who they really are. And one thing I know from all my years at People Magazine is their images are very carefully managed. When you interview them, you know, you are allowed certain questions that are pre-screened in advance. They are in total control. And in fact, I deal with that a little in the book where a lot of the media was doing mea culpas after this exploded again in 2014 and admitting they were among Cosby's enablers. You know, David Carr from the New York Times and a lot of other, because even Ronan Farrow, who went on to do the Harvey Weinstein things, he outed himself saying,
yes,
you know, I was told not to ask these questions. I should have done it. And, you know, he wrote about it. And, you know, so no, we don't know who they are. And also, you know, for media, it's like, don't, just because someone has never publicly been accused of something before and they have this pristine reputation, don't dismiss it when someone comes out and says something. You know, I was a Cosby fan. I loved the Cosby Show. I watched Fat Albert and the Cosby Kids every Saturday growing up. I didn't want to believe this either. And my initial reaction when I was assigned to it was not the cause. I was just, but I put my personal feelings aside and I just started reporting. You know, who we know who he is or who we think he is, but who is she? How does she even know him? What is her reputation like? But who is she? What is her job? Like, what? You know, and the more I found out about her, the more credible
more
she
credible.
Became.
Who is Chloe, how do you say her name, Goines?
Goines,
and she just had a recent deposition, right?
No, they just settled her lawsuit, too. In fact, Cosby's interesting, something I learned during this whole case is, you can get an umbrella. If you have an umbrella homeowner's insurance policy, it covers you for defamation and libel and slander if you're sued.
Uh-huh.
But not for professional, like, not for a story I write, but it would cover me if, like, I wrote a bad Yelp review. So Cosby's insurance company, when all these women begin suing him for defamation, his homeowner's insurance is handling that.
Really?
So once, yeah. Yeah. So once, but once he was convicted, once he was sentenced to jail, the insurance companies were kind of like, enough, let's just settle these. These have been dragging on for 4 years. So they settled them without his consent. They settled with all the women, and Chloe was one of those they settled.
Interesting. And she was assaulted relatively recently?
I think it was 2008, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, okay. So that stretches from 1960 to 2008. When we end up, what needs to be changed? The statute of limitations on reporting these crimes has been increased in some places, right?
But I think it starts with law enforcement. You know, law enforcement has to have better training and more in-depth training about sexual assault and how these cases are. Like, they are the ones on the front lines making these decisions about who gets charged and who doesn't. Prosecutors, too. And, you know, and so many times that's where this stops. And then rape victims, when they do come forward, they're traumatized all over again by the way they're treated by law enforcement. So I think that's where you can make all the laws in the world, but if the people who are supposed to be upholding the laws aren't doing that, there's nothing you can do about it. So I think it really starts with more and better training in law enforcement for sexual assault. You know, do an investigation. Just do a thorough investigation. That will sort out whether it's a false claim, too. I just was talking to someone else who had a false complaint lodged against him, and the investigation that was done pretty quickly turned up, you know, why it was a false report, and, you know, he was never charged or anything. But a lot of times there aren't these thorough investigations, and they're just dismissed, treat the rape victim so badly that they just don't even want to pursue it. So I think that's really what it's about, is more and better training for law enforcement about sexual assault cases.
Well, you got to be commended. You stuck with this the whole time, and the book is, you know, kind of thrilling to read as you wait and see if this guy's going to get justice or not. It's Nicole Wisensee Egan, and the book is Chasing Cosby. Thanks for your time. Chasing Cosby, The Downfall of America's Dad, to give the full title. Nikki, thanks for your time. It was a great piece of work.